Anthropology is the study of human cultures, usually in the aftermath of conquest. As Claude Levi-Strauss wrote, anthropology is not a dispassionate science like astronomy, which springs from the contemplation of things at a distance. It is the outcome of an historical process which has made the larger part of mankind subservient to the other. Well, the other day, the anthropology department at the University of Sydney, the first in Australia, celebrated its centenary, which provoked a good deal of reflection on the impact of anthropology on Indigenous Australians and how anthropology has influenced the way Australians see themselves. Dr. Michael Edwards is a lecturer in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Sydney and one of the organisers of the Centenary Bash. And I welcome him now to the show. Michael, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me, David.
Now, Michael, imagine Levi-Strauss is your student, okay? What marks out of 10 do you give him for that statement?
I think I'd have to give him an 8 or a 9. It's pretty close to the way that we think about the history of anthropology today, the way in which colonization and empire really created the conditions for anthropology's emergence in the sort of first half of the 20th century.
But we credit, don't we, curiosity, the power of curiosity, the willingness, the wish to know about other cultures. That's all fine, isn't it?
I think that's right, David. And I think, you know, this centenary was an opportunity to reflect on what really is a complex history. And I think that's why I give him an 8 or a 9. I think the colonial piece is a huge piece. And I think for decades, anthropologists have reflected on the ways in which their work, their study of quote unquote other cultures has been implicated in the structures and politics of colonization, including here in Australia. At the same time, there's certainly an argument that there's a much broader definition of anthropology and perhaps a certain tradition of ethnographic curiosity, a desire and a will to know and to understand and to make sense of other cultures that might go far back in human history. You know, anthropologists like to claim figures like Herodotus as some of their forefathers, or Ibn Khaldun, the 14th century Arab Muslim scholar, all of whom write about cultures that aren't their own with this kind of ethnographic sensibility. So I think both of these things are in the mix when we think about the history of anthropology today.
It's so fascinating to look at the early colony. And while conquest is going on, there's also curiosity. And we value, don't we, the results of that curiosity, word lists from the 1820s and you know, descriptions by explorers of the rituals they see, the villages they inhabit. I mean, we honour that even if we're a little bit wary of it, don't we?
I think we do. I think we honour the curiosity that motivates that desire to know, even as we recognise that much of that work took place under some pretty horrific conditions, David. And often what was going on was that these descriptions of other cultures here in Australia with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but right around the world, what was written out of the descriptions of those cultures was the wider context in which that fieldwork took place, which was the colonial context that made the fieldwork possible in the first place.
The colonial quest.
The colonial quest.
To conquer.
Indeed, the colonial quest to conquer and to know, and to know. And
because knowing helped the conquest.
Well, in part. And I think there is an argument that, you know, anthropologists have had complicated relationships, like missionaries, say, with colonial administrators in various parts of the world. You know,
yes.
The British anthropologist Wendy James refers to anthropologists as reluctant imperialists. They are often annoying, actually, to colonial administrators, even as in certain ways they also helped those colonial administrators better understand the native populations that they were supposed to govern. So it's an ambiguous and ambivalent relationship with colonization, I think.
In your talk the other night at the Centenary Bash, you talked about Ralph Piddington and the trouble he caused.
Mm.
Tell us about Ralph Piddington.
Well, I think it's a revealing story because it says as much about what anthropologists do say as what they choose not to say about the silences of anthropology as well. So Piddington studied anthropology and psychology at Sydney University. He went on to a PhD at the London School of Economics, funded with a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation of New York, which was funding a lot of anthropology right around the world. Here in Australia, it's a kind of a key part to the story of anthropology's foundation in Australia, as well as what was going on in London. But Piddington, with support of this grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, travels to LaGrange in northwestern Australia and does work with the Gurradjuri people. And in February of 1932, an interview with him is published in what is then a Sydney newspaper, The World. And the headline is Aborigines on Cattle Stations Are in Slavery. And in that interview, Piddington really recounts what he had seen during his fieldwork: slavery, floggings, trafficking, instances of sexual violence as well. And Piddington refers to this as evil. He calls for a government inquiry, and it gets a huge amount, not just of domestic, but also international press.
Because it comes from a scholar?
Because it comes from a scholar, because it breaks the sort of widespread silence on which kind of lays over what much of what's going on in parts of Australia. But it causes controversy. It's entirely rejected by A.O. Neville, who is the chief protector for Aborigines in West Australia at the time. But it also creates a scandal in anthropology, which at that point is really centred around the Sydney department. Because what was very important to the professors of anthropology at that time was maintaining good relations with government. I mean, that's been a really key part of that story. So not putting government offside. Part of that has been about an attempt to ensure at various points access for researchers. Part of it has been about securing funding. But the scandal really was that Piddington had made this major critique of the treatment of Aboriginal people in part of Australia. And Elkin, A.P. Elkin, who would go on to become the professor of anthropology at Sydney in the mid-1930s and really dominate Australian anthropology for two decades, would later write to A.O. Neville and assure him that the future anthropologist that he would send to West Australia would not be like Piddington. In other words, they wouldn't create the kind of scandal, they wouldn't say the kinds of controversial things that he said about the treatment of Aboriginal people. So I think there has been a kind of a politics of, at various points, albeit in complex ways, of complicity and silence. And in the background of a lot of that is the maintenance of, or the attempt to maintain good relations with government.
So exploring marriage rules or kinship or language patterns or how to weave baskets, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But don't have a look at what happens to people on a cattle station. Don't have a look at kidnapped children. Don't have a look at exploitation.
I think that's absolutely right, David. That was the politics of the discipline for some time. I think there was a sense that what anthropology should be doing is focusing on what the Haitian American anthropologist called the savage slot. In other words, to focus on those parts of the world which had been kind of apparently, or at least this is how they were presented, untouched by colonization.
The more savage, the better.
Exactly, because that was a way in which, you know, the quote-unquote West was able to better understand itself. The history of anthropology has moved on a great deal, though I think there are still very serious questions that the discipline grapples with in terms of how it seeks to understand or make sense or explain other cultures and societies.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Michael Edwards, a lecturer in anthropology at the University of Sydney, which faculty is celebrating its centenary. Michael, A.P. Elkin, He's one of that handful of mega scholars who dominated Australian intellectual life for a long time. Tell us about him. What was his impact? Why did he have this sort of, this kind of intellectual heft that counted for so much?
That's right, David. So, I mean, as I said before, Elkin really dominates Australian anthropology from 1933 when he's appointed chair. It's A.R. Radcliffe Brown who founds the department in 26, but he very quickly moves on to Chicago and then to Oxford. There's a brief period where Raymond Firth, a New Zealand anthropologist, is the acting chair, and then Elkin starts in 33 and he holds the chair until the mid-50s.
What's his background?
He comes to anthropology rather late, actually, and he is trained as an Anglican clergyman, and he encounters Aboriginal communities in that context. He goes on to do a PhD with Elliot Smith at University College London. So like so many of the anthropologists at this time, they're trained in London at the London School of Economics for the most part, or Elkin.
That's the mother school, is it?
That's the... In a certain sense, for British social anthropology, which really dominates Australian anthropology, Branislaw Malinowski's department at the LSE from the 1920s onwards really sort of dominates a whole generation of anthropology, including anthropology here. Elkin's trained at UCL, though, and he's trained with Elliot Smith, who is a diffusionist. So he's interested in a certain... paradigm, a certain theoretical paradigm in anthropology that's opposed to what had kind of dominated anthropology really, and including in Australia, really sort of from the 1870s onwards in the wake of Darwin, a sort of social evolutionist paradigm that saw cultures and civilizations moving through various stages of progress.
Improving themselves.
Improving themselves with, in a sort of teleological fashion with Christian, Western.
Or even worse. Worse, Michael, failing to improve themselves.
That too. And I think at the same time, anthropologists who were committed to that particular theoretical paradigm, seeing the study of Indigenous peoples in various parts of the world as a kind of window onto the sort of the early stages of mankind's development. Right. So Elkin is trained by a diffusionist, interested in these... in a different theory of civilizational progress, that civilizations and cultures emerge from contact with one another. And that's what this diffusionist theory is. But he comes back to Australia, and he's really not a major theorist, in fact. And in the rest of the world, Elkin and many of the anthropologists that were trained under Elkin at the University of Sydney were not taken extremely seriously as theorists of culture and society. What they were doing, however, was in-depth ethnographic studies, and particularly here in Australia, but also in the Pacific, because the other part of all of this is that anthropology in Australia, part of the motivation for establishing anthropology in Australia is the need to produce knowledge about, in particular, New Guinea and Papua, these colonies which fall under Australian dominion in the wake of World War I. So that shapes a lot of the early development.
Because we need to know them to control them.
We need to know them to control them. And in fact, up until the end of the Second World War, colonial administrators who would go on to serve in New Guinea did a year of training at the anthropology department at Sydney. After that, ASOPA, the Australian School of Pacific Administration, the teaching there was done by students and staff, largely from the Sydney Anthropology Department, though over the harbour in Mossman. But coming back to Elkin, you know, he dominates Australian anthropology. He dominates it through these kinds of networks of patronage, and his control over, at least initially, those Rockefeller Foundation funds, which are administered through the Australian National Research Council. So he's deciding who gets those funds, where they're able to do research, and he's managing the relations with government that allow access for those anthropologists. He's also directly involved in the management of Aboriginal populations. He's the vice president of the Aborigines Protection Board of New South Wales. So he's very committed to this idea that anthropological knowledge particularly of Indigenous populations, should be useful. It should be useful to government. It should help government manage these populations. Now, perhaps, you know, in contrast to his contemporaries, some of his views might be seen as slightly less sort of explicitly and openly racist. He was opposed to racial segregation. He was opposed to the White Australia policy. And he was in complicated ways an assimilationist.
He was an advocate for citizenship, wasn't he?
He was an advocate for citizenship, but it was still something that was grounded in a paternalistic and a civilizing mission, and he saw anthropology's role as facilitating that.
That, I gather, is no longer the attitude of anthropology. I need to leap forward a bit. You raised the notion of use.
Mm.
What use is made of the material? Tell us about the Thailand scandal.
Mm. So, the Thailand scandal, the Thailand controversy, is another one of these episodes where I think the usefulness or the way in which anthropological knowledge is used and used by whom comes into really sharp relief. So fast forward, we're in the late 1960s, the early 70s. Elkin is no longer the chair.
He's still around,
David. He's still around, including he stays on as the editor for some years of the journal Oceania, which is has been always affiliated with the Sydney University Department and, in fact, is founded by Radcliffe Brown in 1930. So, yes, Elkin stays around. But this is the context of the Cold War. It's the context of Vietnam. And in 1970, two American anthropologists, Eric Wolfe, who's a prominent Marxist anthropologist, and Joseph Jorgensen, write an article in the New York Review of Books called Anthropology on the Warpath in Thailand. And what concerns Wolfe and Jorgensen is that anthropologists are directly involved in counterinsurgency operations in Southeast Asia, funded in large part by the US State Department. Now, in the background of all of this is the controversy around what was known as Project Camelot, which was also a US State Department funded scheme exercise to recruit teams of anthropologists and economists and political scientists and other social scientists to make sense of, but also to engineer social and political and economic change in Latin America. So there's a huge controversy around that.
To beat the Marxists, indeed.
And you know, in interesting ways, these scandals reappeared decades later in the context of the Second Iraq War and Afghanistan and the role played by some anthropologists there in counterinsurgency as well. But this article in the New York Review of Books pays particular attention to the work of what was called the Tribal Research Center, which was a center based out of Chiang Mai, and three anthropologists associated with the Sydney University Department, including the then chair W.R. Geddes, are directly involved with that center. And the allegation is that they are, by virtue of being involved with the Tribal Research Center, supporting counterinsurgency operations in northern Thailand in the context of Vietnam. Now, this creates a huge scandal in anthropology globally, but also beyond anthropology as well. And you know, of course, at this time, the Sydney University Department is really a sort of a flashpoint for protests against the Vietnam War.
I remember. I was there.
Right, David. Well, I wonder if you remember the Tribal Research Center and these...
No, I don't.
Right. Well, from what I understand, I wasn't there, but from what I understand is that... at the, you know, near daily meetings on the front lawns of Sydney University, you know, students who were protesting against the Vietnam War, at least when this article was in the news, were also very angry about the role of the anthropology department. There was talk of an occupation of the anthropology department.
I'm surprised
at that
it didn't
time.
Happen.
it seems like it may not have happened, which is also surprising to me.
And did the anthropology department learn a lesson from this? Did it decide from this point on, the 60s, my God, that's a long time ago now, that they weren't going to take part in operations of this kind?
Well, I think they certainly did. I think there's a few things to say about that and about this episode in general. I think, you know, this happens in the context not just of Vietnam, but of decolonization movements happening right around the world. And in that context, a real reckoning within anthropology of the ethics of research in a decolonizing world. I think the other thing to say about the controversy, you know, when I brought this up at the gathering to mark the centenary, you know, a week and a half or whenever it was ago, there were gasps in the room when I mentioned the Thailand controversy. So I think, you know, this is still a very live issue, actually, and there are people who were trained by the anthropologists who have been sort of accused of these things at that time. And I think it's worth saying that those anthropologists have narrated their involvement in that controversy very, very differently. And for some of them, they say that the controversy was in fact overblown. It misunderstood exactly what this center
we're
was.
We're familiar with the phenomenon of people involved in events of this kind having a different view of them to the critics who are looking from the outside.
I think that's right. And I think the three anthropologists who are involved had in retrospect, a different view of...
it's deeply human. You could study this.
Well, indeed, I think there's sort of a need to approach anthropology as a discipline almost ethnographically, right? To pay attention to the kinds of politics and relations. You know, anthropologists are particularly interested in sociality and relationality. So the very relations and sociality that constitute the discipline.
In their own department.
Even in their own department.
Now, look, we've been talking about the ethics of use. Let's talk about the ethics of collection.
Mm.
Once upon a time, you just went out into the bush, you made contact of some kind with an indigenous population, you walked into that population and said, tell me your secrets. It doesn't work like that anymore, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't work like that anymore. I think, you know, one product, I think, of the self-reflection that has taken place in anthropology since the 1970s, at least, if not earlier, but then right through the 1980s and through to today, I think has been that perhaps more than other disciplines, I think anthropologists tend to, though this is speaking in very sort of broad terms, take their kind of responsibilities and the ethics of their research, their responsibilities to their research interlocutors very seriously now, and think through these questions about research, about data, about data sovereignty, about how anthropologists, especially in their ethnographic writing, represent the people who they got to know, who they spent these extended periods of time with during fieldwork. So I think it's fair to say we think through those questions in a far deeper way today. I think the danger is saying that those questions have completely gone away. And I think what's really important in telling these histories of the discipline and sort of reflecting on the discipline today is to avoid what the anthropologists Brigapati Singh and Jane Geyer call an Oedipal approach to the history of anthropology.
What is that?
An Oedipal approach would be an approach to say, let's talk about how horrible all of our disciplinary forefathers and ancestors were, and narrate a story to the sort of bright, enlightened present of today. Now, I think that's a problem. I think it's a problem because not only does it get in the way of a kind of a more complex and nuanced engagement with the history of the discipline in this place and elsewhere, but I think it also lets us off the hook today when in our universities we're no less implicated in the same or similar structures of power that I think as scholars of relations we need to reckon with still.
Michael, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me, David.
I've been talking to Dr. Michael Edwards, lecturer in anthropology at the University of Sydney, that faculty has just celebrated its centenary, which has led to this thoughtful reflection on the history of anthropology in this country and its future. This is Late Night Live.